you would be in favor of an amendment to this bill which would bring out the choice system that's used in Australia. Is that correct?
Sure. And you could even then raise the raise your limit from 40% to 51% if you wanted to. You wouldn't have to settle for a 40% majority if you didn't want to. You could ballot until you had 51%. I mean, you use the same ballot. You don't have to vote again. But you
do you know of any case where this is being done currently in the United States?
I'm not aware of any, no.
Do you know of anything that would preclude a state from putting this into their statutes?
Not at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Sykes.
Thank you very much.
Rhonda, does the Democratic Party have any position at all? No position. Anybody else have a comment on this proposed bill? Mr. Whitaker?
Yes, Mr. Whitaker, I think this is a misguided effort here. What you really need to do is look at Title 15 as a whole, which really has been ignored for a great long while. The loophole that Wally and Jack got in on through ought to be closed. That would solve this problem. When you only have Democrat and Republican, Green, and Alaska Independence Party candidates, you aren't going to have the eventuality that somebody doesn't get at least 40% of the law. That's a possibility because we do have a multi-party system, but I think that the chances of that happening are somewhat remote.
Sounds like some of you maybe would rather have everybody on one ballot for the primary and then the top two people for the general. Maybe that's another alternative.
Oh, I think that would tend to disenfranchise the political parties who have people on the general election ballot. It's been a great long while since the legislature looked at Title 15, and it does need, portions of it do need to be written. And there ought to be some independent authority that, in particular, addresses the statute of disqualified candidates. Under existing state statute, it was illegal that Jack Cockhill's name was put on the ballot. Because it was illegal, Wally Hickel's was illegal also. The state statute reads that the disqualified candidate's name shall not be placed on the general election ballot. The reason for that is to prevent the circumlocution of the law that Jack Cockhill and Wally Hickel did. When you have a partisan person such as Lieutenant Governor McAlpine in charge of enforcing that law and has at his discretion the option of placing that those people on the ballot contrary to state law, you've got a problem. So I would place an independent authority or person on that one particular statute to close that loophole. I don't have any faith in Mr. Cockhill upholding state law in this regard.
Thank you, Mr.
If you did that, you wouldn't have this problem of a majority.
Thank you, sir. Roberts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Democratic Party hasn't actually taken a position on this. We have talked about it, and recognizing that there are now four recognized parties in the state and perhaps more to come, that we do feel like there should be some kind of further decision-making than we've got now so that more people actually, a larger percentage would be electing the governor. In theory, it could get down with four recognized parties that the governor would be elected by 25%. And so we think that something does need to be changed. In just thinking about Mr. Sykes' proposal, I think that I would agree that needs some further investigation. Because we do have more than two parties. This is an interesting proposal. I think that it should really have some serious consideration and be investigated. I can see the problems of the actual ballot counting procedure, but that would certainly cost less than running two statewide elections. So,
Senator Moyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Roberts, will the party take an actual position on this at their next central committee meeting?
We probably could do that. It's not until January. But we, it should be something. February. It should be something that's discussed. And we could take it.
Representative Brackman?
This is actually more for the Division of Elections, but I'm curious if the computer could handle the statistical end of counting that kind of ballot and the timeline it would take for results to come in.
Division of Elections will maybe do us a little analysis of Mr. Sykes' suggestion and for our next meeting and see what kind of good or bad things, problems that you would have with it, or possibly how it might work.
And Ms. Roberts, you said that the State Central Committee of the Democratic Party meets in February?
It's in January.
In January.
It's really cool. Almost February 1st.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, Representative Shilke?
Thank you. Since we're asking for questions, that we've lost all of our attorneys. I would truly like to be convinced that this type of a percentage basis is constitutionally allowable. I don't know if that could go to you, Elizabeth, or what, but it seems to me that...
Constitutionally on state or federal grounds?
I think federal.
And this is an amendment to our Constitution, so it's certainly allowable.
Sure, sure. I'm wondering if we have any superseding law. My question is, Australia's had this for some time, I understand, and why have we not...
You're talking about that.
Reviewed it before. Why has this not been brought to our attention earlier, and why has this not been incorporated in other states? So if there's going to be some questions answered, I would like that question answered also.
I've been two parties mostly. In Australia, they've got 6 or 7 parties.
Okay, anything else from
that? No, thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to comment on this bill? Okay, hearing none, my plan on this bill is to... Who knows? Who knows what the plan on that bill is? But we'll talk about some more, certainly in Fairbanks. We're going to recess for 1 hour for lunch, and then at such time when we come back, we'll be taking up HJR 45. Constitutional amendment relating to reapportionment board, and then HDR 47 relating to confirmation of public officials, and HDR 38 relating to constitutional debt retirement fund. And we'll be back at 1 o'clock. Call back to order the House State Affairs Committee. Next on the agenda is HDR 45. Relating to reapportionment board and reapportionment. It's a constitutional amendment which would transfer the responsibility of the reapportionment from the governor to an independent board. HJR 45 intends also to correct provisions in the Constitution which have been held to be unconstitutional under federal law. We have the sponsors, we have the sponsor of the bill, the House Judiciary Committee Chairman, Representative Dave Donnelly. Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a very accurate short summary of the legislation. Apparently every case that I can remember examining where the reapportionment issue has been brought before the Alaska Supreme Court, they have specifically recommended to the legislature that we amend the Constitution to at least conform with the Voting Rights Act. As you know, if you were just to pick up the Alaska Constitution and try to understand reapportionment, no chance, because there's so large parts of the existing Constitution have been overruled by the Federal Voting Rights Act and have subsequently have to be disregarded. So it's very difficult for the average citizen, looking at our state constitution, to even try to understand how reapportionment works in our state. Also, it's very archaic because the time frame set out in the Constitution were based on 1950s technology, and we have computerization today, and we could do a much more rapid, efficient process of reapportionment and really serve the public by providing much more time before the next election for people to get their new election districts together. Additionally, the legislation seeks to create an independent board that wouldn't be subject to either the legislature for override or the governor for override, to establish the new districts and boundaries. I think that would be that's what many other states already do. Mr. Chairman, as you know, Alaska is one of only two states in the United States where the governor conducts reapportionment. And I think the members are familiar with the historical glitch that caused that. And I see former Senator Fisher is here today who could testify to that. In the 1950s, when our Constitution was being drafted, courts were not finding reapportionment issues to be justiciable issues, so that many legislatures, or some, were just simply refusing to reapportion themselves. So to address that issue, the Constitutional Convention of our state gave the power to the governor. Subsequent to that, in the 60s, courts did start to decide and compel legislatures to apportion themselves. So one of the basic premises behind the uniqueness of our Constitution is archaic and no longer exists. The plan, we examined plans from all over the United States in putting this plan together. We tried to insulate it as much as possible from politics. And going through, there'd be a 9-member board. The governor would get to appoint one. That's very unusual. Very few states allow the governor any input into apportionment, so that we've really given the governor a bonus here compared to the national standard. And the House caucus of the party with largest members would have two. The House caucus of the party with the next largest number of members would have two. So we're giving equal numbers to both the minority and the majority parties, and the same in the Senate, both in the House and the Senate. We'd also specifically say in the Constitution that these individuals who sit on the board couldn't be a public official or public employee. They couldn't run for legislative office in the next two elections after their term on the reapportionment board expires. We try to insulate it a little more. We make more specific the existing prohibition that it should be nonpartisan, to make it very clear that no more than 5 members of the board, or the simplest majority, could be from the same party. As you know, the board we have today has 4 of the 5 from one party. And no more than 5 members could be from the same judicial district. I think there's going to be some recommendations we'll see as we work on this some more, maybe to modify some of those things to make it a little easier to put together. But at this point, this is the starting proposal. Also, that the selection of chair would be elected by the board members, and if there's an impasse and they couldn't pick a chair, then the majority of the Supreme Court would choose a chair for the board. And that way we try to insulate it even more from the political process there, to keep the ball rolling sort of towards a good reapportionment plan. So that's, in a nutshell, it. And I'd be happy to take any questions, or if you want to proceed to public testimony.
Could you, trying to go through this board, how many people is it all together?
9 members. And that's just an arbitrary number. We looked at other boards all across the United States. They ranged everywhere from 7 to 13, and that range kind of came down in between the examples that we found. We're looking for an odd number.
Yeah. What do you do about the Senate here, they don't really have caucuses. They seem to organize on a whole, but they would still appoint 4 people. It looks like it would go as 2 Republicans or 2 Democrats. But, I mean, normally is how it would work out.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. And, you know, we've been trying to think of all the little twists and turns that occur with, you know, politics in Alaska. So we're trying as much as possible to address that. Instead of saying the majority and the minority, we said the caucus with the largest number of members, and then the caucus with the second largest number of members, because you never know, you may have a third party in there also. So.
Representative Moyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Donnelly, on page 2, line 29 and 30, well, I agree with that noble addition. How would you show that it was intent to give the bans, or prove there was or wasn't?
Well, the burden would be on the litigants that brought the case, obviously. I just think it would be, certainly that's the intent of the people who drafted our Constitution, is that politics not be part of this. But unfortunately, I think they've been part of every reapportionment. And by specifically saying more clearly in the Constitution, I think when we all take our oath of office, it might have an impact on us and inhibit that gerrymandering effect a little more.
Another question here about having a report come out. I'm on page 4. No later than 14 months before the election. How logistically could you do that with knowing that the numbers from the reapportionment or from the census won't really be available? You want to talk about that?
Yeah, when we drafted this, we sat down and worked out a timeline with the census numbers and with the Division of Elections information. We felt this was the earliest the plan could come out. We wanted to pick the earliest possible date for the plan.
I guess that's 14 months. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and as near as the information we got when we drafted it, this was about the earliest you could have one produced. And that was our real goal, to give as much warning and time as possible before the next election.
Representative Bruckner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Godley, on page 2, section 3, the word resident, comparing the word civilian. Could you explain? Yeah.
I think that's one of the things we had to do to comply with the Voting Rights Act. Maybe Lori Otto could help me on that. The changing of the word civilian to resident?
That's another one that we need to do as a result of the court decision to compare the word resident.
I'm sorry, look, could you come up? Yeah. Just because we have people online and...
For the record, my name is Lori Otto. I'm staff counsel to the House Judiciary Committee. The reason that we changed civilian to resident is, once again, as Representative Donnelly described, another context to conform to the requirements of the United States Constitution and the U.S. Voting Rights Act. If somebody is a resident of the state of Alaska and they happen to be in the military, by limiting redistricting, if you only count civilian population, you're disenfranchising Alaska residents who are in the military, which we constitutionally can't do. So it's one of the amendments that's to conform to what we have a legal obligation to do under federal law.
Thank you. And Representative Donnelly, would you then be eliminating the number in the legislature and leaving that up to the reapportionment board to decide? In other words, 40, so you're eliminating the language where the population is divided by 40.
I think that appears in another part of the Constitution. It states how many members of the House and how many members of the Senate.
Well, I mean, I know it does appear in the Constitution, but you're just eliminating that from statute or the language.
Yeah. Representative Ruckman, what specific section are you referring to now?
Page 2, line 26,
Okay, 26.
Also line 32.
Yeah. The intent there is not to delete or amend the size of the legislative body, but to conform with the civilian population, getting the civilian reference to civilian out of it.
Okay. Representative Moyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Donnelly, I read in the paper about the unfortunate passing of Senator Ziegler from Ketchikan, former state senator, and it makes me think of a question. How is replacement of someone on the board handled should they pass away while in office? And secondly, this should sound familiar. Under what grounds can someone be removed from the board by governor or anyone else?
Well, after last session, those are both good questions that I hadn't really specifically thought that much about in the context of this proposal, and probably we should incorporate some specific provision for that. This board would be appointed once every 10 years, so I mean, there's a lower probability of those problems coming up on this board than there are at some of the more permanent boards, but it certainly is something we might want to specifically address.
Well, the question would be, do we address it all in the Constitution or elsewhere? Can we legislatively take care of details. Other comments from the committee, Representative Donovan? Hearing none, no.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Larson.
Thank you. I just have one question in relation, I think, to legislative intent. And I don't know whether this would be the appropriate time to bring it up or not, but it has to do with existing language, but it is on page 2, line 25. And I think what we have there is something that the committee should discuss some here. Starting on line 24, it says, shall be formed of contiguous and compact territories containing as nearly as practicable a relatively integrated social economic area, with the key word being practicable. Does that mean you must do it if at all possible, or does it mean you only do it after you considered everything else? I think that's a word that legislatively we need to give some intent to in our language, because I think it's very important. To me, if it says containing as nearly as practicable, I mean, if it's at all possible, you must meet the contiguous in compact districts. For example, the way it's being interpreted under the present reapportionment plan is that after you considered everything else, then if it's still practical, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
See? And
of course, maybe just a little interjection there is, with this board again, maybe these arguments may not be as needed as strongly because you have more of a non-political or more of a bipartisan approach to this board rather than the political nature of the way it was done probably every time since it's been done before.
Yes. I bring it up with a intent. I saw Senator Fisher in the audience, and if he speaks and as a member of the Constitutional Convention, I would appreciate hearing his impression of what the word practicable means.
Other comments? Hearing none, let's have Senator Fisher, could we have you first, sir?
Mr. Chair, my name is Vic Fisher. I'm testifying on my own behalf, and so I'll go ahead and give you a few comments.
Your words of wisdom would be greatly
appreciated. Well, I'm not sure there'll be words of wisdom, but at least there'll be my words. Mr. Chairman, I am really glad that the legislature is working on recasting Article 6 of the Constitution. About a dozen years ago, I was doing some work for a legislative committee preparing for a possible constitutional convention, and one of my assignments was to look at issues that were or should be before the people of Alaska in terms of constitutional revision when considering the question of 10 years ago, shall it be a constitutional convention? And one of the outstanding examples of the need for revision was the reapportionment article, because essentially, the article is obsolete provisions, as was pointed out. Provisions are archaic, and it simply hasn't been working. It certainly has not worked the way it was conceived. Initially, there were some guidelines in there that had to be thrown out as a result of the Baker versus Carr decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. And but beyond that, it has not worked because initially, the provision to give the governor the reapportionment power, the reapportionment, I guess it would be power, not just authority, it is power. It was put in essentially for two reasons. One was seeing legislatures were simply reluctant to reapportion themselves, and both because in those days before Baker versus Carr, there was a pattern of rural domination regardless of change. It was the same district. And plus, in part going with that, the natural defense mechanism of the legislature does a reapportionment. The legislators have a vested interest in protecting their own districts. regardless of what kind of changes are needed. The governor at that point was seen, and those were times of great idealism, the governor was seen as an individual who represented the majority, preferably all Alaskans, but certainly the majority of Alaskans, and he, she would be responsible to the people of Alaska and be responsive to their needs and their will. The article has not functioned, and the evidence of that is that regardless of whether we have Democratic or Republican governors who were involved in reapportionment, it's been a court judicial reapportionment rather than executive. We got rid of a legislative reapportionment, tried the executive, and it ended up judiciary. And the judiciary is not really constituted to do reapportionment, yet there was no other way to accomplish it under our system. And therefore, I do believe that the vision, the direction that is being pursued in the proposed constitutional amendment is very desirable. Let me make just a couple of comments. I think the specific concept of selecting members of the reapportionment board from different, sort of via different constituencies, via different appointment authorities, is good, because that way you don't get the kind of single purpose appointment that you have now. The director can say it shall be bipartisan or appointments without regard to politics, to partisan politics, yet you can always find somebody on any side of the political fence who will agree with you, and you can put whatever labels are appropriate on them and say, see, we've done it. By looking to different constituencies for the appointment, I think you're liable to get the kind of diversity that's important in effectively putting together a bipartisan, truly bipartisan board. I just have a couple of minor comments, almost quibbles. I think that if at all possible, we should keep the Supreme Court out of it. I see no particular reason for asking the Supreme Court to get involved in the question of who shall be chair. That's a very political decision. It should be an internal decision. You have an odd-numbered board. An odd-numbered board can't decide. We're really in trouble, and they should be in trouble. Maybe there should be new appointments made or some other device, but I would sure keep the court out of a provision like that. Section 9, which would have meant Article 10 of the Section 10 of Article 6, a couple of questions. First of all, if you have a bipartisan board, let's say you have five members of one party, four of another, you're liable to get a reapportionment plan adopted on strictly partisan lines. And you might give consideration for requiring a two-thirds vote for adoption of a reapportionment plan. So at least there'd be an attempt made to cross partisan lines. The other thing, I couldn't quite follow the discussion, but a question arose in my mind about the 14 months, not later than 14 months before the date of the first general election, following the reporting of each decennial census, the board shall adopt the primary reapportionment plan. What if the census reporting comes out 19 months before the general election, or 17 months? Do we have to wait 3.5 years? I didn't quite follow the math. Maybe anyway, control when the census reporting is accomplished, and you want to make sure that we don't sit around for a couple of years waiting for the reapportionment to take effect. And also, I hate to see provisions based on sort of a federal administrative action. Another suggestion I would have on Section 12, which provides for reapportionment of legislature following 1990 census, I think it might be wise to put a lapse date for this particular section so it automatically got out of the Constitution. So unlike what we have now, where transitional measures have remained in there since transition to statehood, we sort of automatically clean the Constitution as we go. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, I think it is wonderful to see Section 14 finally dropping out of the Constitution. That's the one that describes the House and Senate districts. And the initial Constitution had those in, and then subsequently, the Lieutenant Governor simply substituted the descriptions after each reapportionment and put them in the Constitution, which wasn't, they had no legal right to do so, yet we kept encumbering the Constitution with nonsense, you know, detailed descriptions. So I think it's great to wipe that out because it doesn't really belong in the Constitution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Questions from the committee? Representative Donner.
I really appreciate your comments, Senator Fisher. As to Section 12, I just wanted to give you a little thinking behind that. My intent was not that that be only a transitional section, although it certainly is appropriate considering the situation we're in now, but that it be a permanent section. And many states utilize a similar system to discourage gerrymandering, in that if there's the option for people, for incumbents or other individuals to run within areas that maybe you're referring to Section 12 of the bill, not Section...
I'm talking about Section 12 of the bill, Section 29.
Okay.
Well, I fully agree with you on Section 12 of Article 6.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, never mind.
Other questions, comments from the committee? Senator Larson, would you like to pose your question earlier?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question earlier, Senator, had to do, I guess, with your position as being one of the delegates of the Constitutional Convention. And on the bill, it's referred to on page 2, line 25, when it states, contain as nearly as practical a relatively integrated social economic area. Does the word there, practical, mean that it's a top priority, or does the word practical mean that it's a lesser priority and only be considered after other things have been considered?
Well, in my interpretation, Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, is that that would be a guideline that would apply unless there was other overriding reason to make this impractical.
Then you're saying that the social economic is a top priority, not one of the lesser priorities.
I would say it's a very high priority. I would see it, for instance, violated to some extent within the Anchorage urban area, where essentially you are dividing integrated socioeconomic areas. So that even within Anchorage, I would say, you were trying to keep neighborhoods together, you were trying to draw rational boundaries, but you can't totally integrate socioeconomic areas. But certainly, if it is at all possible to create an integrated socioeconomic area, if anything, you go out of your way to do it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add that the constitutional convention record is real clear at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for me? Senator Fisher, we certainly appreciate your time today.
As I said, I'm glad you're working on this.
I'm going to skip around. I believe we may have some other people here. Let me go to Ketchikan right now. Bob Weinstein, you online?
This is the moderator of Ketchikan, and Mr. Weinstein has left. Thank you.
Thank you. In Soldotna, Mayor Gilman.
Yes, sir.
Mayor Gilman, would you like to address this bill to the committee?
I'm here for HGR 38.
All right, sir. I'm third. Sorry. Is there anyone online to testify in this bill? Right, is there anyone here else? Kirk? Come on up.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kurt Wickersham, and I have watched and participated in the current redistricting process as one of the co-chairs of the Democratic Party's reapportionment committee, although my comments this afternoon are just on my own behalf, not on behalf of the party. I strongly support this bill and the concept behind it. My primary reason is that it is the existing process is seriously flawed. The period of time that candidates, potential candidates, and constituents are in limbo under the current process is far too long, and the limbo is far too broad. We start with the reapportionment committee. When they make their report, the governor has up to 90 days to engage in his or her own reapportionment process, which may totally ignore the work of the reapportionment board and the people that have participated in that process. After the governor's action takes place, of course, we have the Federal Justice Department, and then, based on the experience of the last few reapportionments, 1 to 2 years of litigation. In fact, it isn't the governor who reapportions this state, it's the state Supreme Court, or a Superior Court judge that's acting under direction from the Supreme Court. During that period of time, we are not in a one-person, one-vote situation because, in fact, population has shifted and we don't have election districts that conform to that. After that process is over, and this is the other point that I would like to make about the process, is that the process does not produce sensible results. Everyone knows about the Donut District and the 1984 reapportionment. Everybody knows about the Frequent Flyer District and the existing reapportionment. About a third of the people in the new district were also constituents in the Donut District. Those are just the tip of the iceberg. There are very few districts that make sense from a socioeconomic standpoint that actually establish communities of interest that can be sensibly represented by representatives and senators. So I strongly support this. I believe that it is possible to take most of the politics out of the reapportionment process, and that this bill would do it. In terms of specific provisions, Section 4, I have a personal preference for single-member districts for the House and the Senate because I think that it will reduce the cost of campaigning and increase personal contact between the elected official and the constituent. I'm not sure that I would want to put that in the Constitution, however, I know that the Justice Department favors that. I'm not sure that I want to put it in the Constitution as far as House districts are concerned, because there may be some instances in urban areas where dual-member House districts would be appropriate. But I do think that we ought to cap it at dual-member districts, and I don't think that dual-member Senate districts are advantageous or appropriate, and I would prescribe those. In terms of Representative Larson's question, it seems to me that once we've complied with the one-person, one-vote requirement, Title V of the Voting Rights Act, I think that socioeconomic homogeneity should be the primary guiding force in determining district boundaries, and that the remaining considerations in that section should be used to attempt to achieve that goal of homogeneous socioeconomic districts. So with that, those are my comments on this, and I certainly hope that you pass this and that you move it forward to the voters, and that this process be used in the future for reapportionment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Larson.
Yeah, just one general question. The one person, one vote, and where practical for social and economic, I guess my question has to do with, in order to keep the one person, one vote, and say zero tolerance difference of all the districts, is that a higher priority than the social economic, or is the social economic fit in there someplace in regards to the voter deviation of up to 10%?
I think it fits in. The 10% requirement, it's my understanding the Justice Department treats 10% as prima facie compliant with the requirements of Baker versus Carr. And so that isn't a maximum cap. That's just the safe tolerance level in which the Justice Department will not challenge. The direct answer to that question is that I think that we should go to the maximum of 10% deviation in order to achieve socioeconomic homogeneity. Beyond that, you know, I think that a future reapportionment board would have to look on a case-by-case basis. But I think it is legally possible, and I think in some instances it would be desirable either to keep cultural and ethnic groups together in Bush districts, to keep small towns and their environs in a single district, or for other perfect common sense reasons. I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out the cultural and socioeconomic communities of interest in this state.
Chairman, I take it then that you believe that some tolerance should be granted in order to achieve the social and economic.
Yes, I think that the tolerance within the 10% either way is appropriate, and that's why it's there in the law, and we should take advantage of it. Beyond 10% is legally possible and may be desirable in some instances.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the point I was trying to make is that I don't even know if the census that was taken is within the 2% tolerance that the present board tried to hold to. So trying to hold to that is compounding an error already.
Other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Porter, did you want to address us or?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to address us on this issue? Yeah?
Mr. Chairman?
Could you speak as loud as you can? It's hard for them to hear.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ollie Isaacson. I'm representing Mayor Jesse Colley of North Central. I'd like to first thank you, Mr. Chairman of the Committee, for the controversy currently surrounding Governor Hickel's reapportionment plan. We believe this legislation is timely, and we support the intent of this proposed legislation. Being only one of two states in our nation where the governor has sole control of and responsibility for redistricting, our feeling is that Alaska must join the other states and provide a more equitable and judicious means of reapportionment. The creation of an independent board responsible for redistricting, as described in the proposed legislation, would help to eliminate the influence of partisan politics in the redistricting process. Any constitutional amendments would also need to address the provisions of reapportionment considered unconstitutional under federal law. We caution, however, that partisan politics may still be possible under the proposed criteria for the makeup of the board. While it is clear that no more than five members of the board can be of the same political party or reside in the same judicial district, the proposed makeup of the board allows for the representation of only two political parties. This would effectively eliminate the participation of any other political party from those two in power. Furthermore, it is not clear whether all members of the board, either those appointed by the governor or those by the legislature, are to be appointed from the general public. This should specifically be stated as a qualification. The proposed constitutional amendment under Section 3, Article 6 states that reapportionment shall be based upon the resident population within each election district. We wholeheartedly support such a provision because of problems we have encountered with the governor's reapportionment plan. Under the governor's plan, for example, the community of Tyonek shares little in common with us in North Slope, included in our district. Furthermore, the strength of votes of the voters in our district is diluted by the questionable inclusion of non-resident military personnel in our population base. HJFR 45 also proposes to amend Section 6, Article 6, states that the election boundaries may not be drawn with the intent of giving an advantage to a particular political party. We fully agree with this. Under the governor's plan, one minority rural Alaskan legislative seat was eliminated and one majority urban seat was retained. We don't think this is fair. The ground rules need to be set out plainly in the Constitution. As it is now, the reapportionment process carried out by the governor unnecessarily creates dissension among the rural regions and native groups throughout our state and exacerbates any divisiveness which may exist between rural and urban Alaska. We believe it's time for constitutionally mandated change. Again, we appreciate this opportunity to provide our comments and recommendations. We believe this proposed legislation is not only timely, but would also help resolve many existing problems in the reapportionment process.
Mayor. Questions from the committee?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience? Whitaker?
My name is Jed Whitaker. I don't agree with, I think it ought to be single member districts in reference to line 15 on the second page. I think section 6 is very good. In regards to how or who should be on the reapportionment board, I would advocate that there ought to be five members who are nonpartisan, and in that way, the majority of the voters who are nonpartisan, that reflects the political makeup of Alaska. And I would make the other four seats one representative per party. I think line 24 on page 3, member of the reapportionment board may not be a candidate for legislature in two general elections following adoption of the final report of the plan on the circle is good. On page 5, section 12, I think that those two sentences there, 1 through 8, would be very confusing to the voters, so I think you ought to clarify that. And finally, section 29, we've got first sentence of that is over 100 words. It's about 150 words. I think the sentence is too long. I think you ought to break it down. There's too many clauses in it. If you read it, you can comprehend it. However, the sentence is too long. So I would hope you would try. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wakeford. Anyone else? Is there anyone from the administration here that position?
Staff maybe to write the governor's office a letter and ask them for their comments. We did ask them for their comments, did we not? All right, unless anybody has anything else, Representative Donnelly will work on some of the comments that we've got and maybe have by November 12th talk about some of those and maybe have an alternative on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. The next one before us should be a shorter one here. HDR 47 relating to confirmation of public officials. Again, it's a constitutional amendment which would make appointments to public corporations and the director of insurance subject to legislative confirmation. We have the sponsor of this bill here in Representative Donnelly, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When our state constitution was drafted, there was very few, if any, of the creatures known as public corporations around. So when the Constitution addressed the power of the legislature to confirm appointments to boards and commissions, it specified that the heads of principal departments and any regulatory or quasi-judicial agency. Since that time, public corporations have become very popular animals to create, and very frequently they have more duties and even more employees than entire departments of state government, and have been very much removed from the balance of powers and checks and balances system of our government, because we have no ability to confirm the appointments to these boards that have these pretty sweeping powers, including very often regulatory powers, although they have been interpreted as being regulatory bodies, which is very interesting. There's a serious debate between attorneys on that subject. Even though these agencies may have the power to adopt regulations or what is essentially regulations, they're not considered regulatory, so we still don't have confirmation powers. And this would simply bring that back into line what I think the drafters of our Constitution would have incorporated in there if they would have ever envisioned the creation of all these public corporations on the scope that we have today. The second section deals with the director of the Division of Insurance. And this is a very unique office in the state of Alaska, because unlike almost every other position, the director of the Division of Insurance has specific statutory powers and statutory mandates that go beyond their chain of command to the commissioner. In other words, the commissioner, the Department of Commerce Economic Development, cannot direct the director of the Division of Insurance to do certain things. The director is independent from the department head. And although it's a line agency within the department, the director has statutory responsibilities and duties above those his responsibility as a subordinate to the commissioner. The vast majority of states either have confirmation of their equivalent to the director of the insurance. In many states, it's an entirely separate department, or actually elect at a public election, popular election, their division directors. Clearly, it's appropriate for somebody who has specific statutory obligations that go beyond the control of the department head to have legislative confirmation for that individual. It's a very unique position in our state government. It's been recommended to me by individuals that maybe we want to change the name of this position from director to something that's unique, because it is such a unique position, to maybe superintendent or some other name, title, czar, it doesn't matter, so that it's not comparable to directors in other agencies, which it simply isn't. It isn't a comparable to a directorship in other parts of our bureaucracy because they have this unique statutory powers.
Comments from the committee? Anyone out there would like to comment on this amendment? We have no position from the administration on this one either. I think that we'll also ask for this one. Is there anyone, Representative Moyne?
Well, I think I just answered my own question. Your memo outlining existing corporations is February, so it wouldn't include any that passed last session. I see why that's the
space.
Case.
Are we thinking about space?
Yes, of course.
Space
is important. I'm thinking about space. Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone on the teleconference that would like to comment on this bill? Hearing none. We'll have this on the agenda again in November, too, and see if we get some response from the administration on it.
Yeah, plus we observed the mic away, so this is...
Yeah, the mic doesn't exist anymore.
The last item on our agenda for today is HDR 38. HDR 38 relating to Constitutional Debt Retirement Fund. It's a constitutional amendment which would dedicate revenue to a fund to pay for debt service and to finance capital projects. The fund was established in statute during the 91 session by SB 235, and this constitutional amendment is needed to protect that fund, permanentize it. Mr. Stassing? This resolution was introduced. We have discussed it once before in committee. It was introduced at the request of the governor. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, my name is Shelby Stastny. I'm the director of the Office of Management and Budget. I have with me Jack Kreingetter, who works in my office and has done most of the technical work regarding this particular amendment. As I mentioned to this committee before, the concept that we have in HDR 38 is a concept that is of utmost importance to the governor and to the people of Alaska. We've, for many years, been down the road where the revenues that come in because of the pressures and the political pressures of different things that different constituency want, we end up with all of our money going towards the operations rather than reinvesting it for the future. We feel like it's absolutely essential to put some of that money away so that we can invest it now and for the future. Obviously, the now investment is to pay off the debt. We currently have, before last year's payment, about $1 billion of general obligation debt and a debt that we're responsible for because of our school debt obligations. Our concern is that when we get down the road with declining revenues, the pressures will be there to use those revenues to continue to fund operations of government. That's usually the easiest course to take, is to not necessarily fund the capital projects and the other things that need to be taken care of, because they don't have the ongoing constituency that the general operation of government has. So we believe that 25% of the permanent fund revenues, the same stream of revenues that's currently going in, 25% of the owner state revenues, the royalties and other things, the same stream of revenues that's going into the permanent fund ought to be directed to this investment type fund. As I've characterized it before, the permanent fund is kind of our portfolio of stocks and securities. 25% of our revenues are going in there. We propose that 25% be channeled for another kind of investment, a kind of investment that's going to produce infrastructure and jobs and those kinds of things that our generations of the future will be able to look to generate future revenues for the state and to better their standard of living and their quality of life. The bill that was passed last year set up the mechanism in statute to have money appropriated to the debt retirement fund, but if we don't put this in concrete in the Constitution, the pressures are going to be there in the future to not fund these kinds of things that need to be funded in the future. Now, another point I might make is that political pressures in the past, as you all know, have required, not maybe not required, but have ended up in the proposition that we haven't paid our fair share of debt to our school districts. Districts that we committed to pay, we told them when they closed the box we were going to pay it. But when it came right down to it, to appropriating the money to do it, only in last year we did it all because of this fund, so maybe two out of the prior 10 years now, but we stepped up to the plate and paid what we should. And that's just an indication of what, I'm not telling you anything you don't know because you get the political pressures as much as we do, just an indication of what the political pressures do when it comes to make a decision whether we're going to invest the money where we should or whether we're going to bow to the pressures of continuing to fund operations of government. So that's generally what the administration feels about this bill. We think that the people of Alaska should have a chance to vote on it, to be told the story. We intend to do that and give them the chance to say, yes, this is a good idea, or no, it isn't.
Comments from the committee? Representative Larson.
Yes. In regards to education debt service, you're saying that was the state only paid its obligation in two of the last 10 years?
I haven't researched that, Representative. I've been told that by others, and that's
probably pretty close. It's
my recollection that the amount of dollars put forth for debt service has, in one way or another, at least within the last 5 years, been paid except for once. How much did you veto out of debt service this year?
This year we didn't veto out any.
Okay, then we fully won in the last 5 years that debt service has been underfunded. And before that, I can't think of any examples.
That's not the report I've been given, but I didn't personally research it.
I'll have to go back and check on that.
Well, I'm sure the year before last we did not fully fund school debt return. I know we didn't.
That was the year I was thinking of.
Last year we did. In fact, my impression was last year was the first year we had in several years.
I remember moving $3.5 million around that we had set aside one time in fully fund debt service. That was 3 years ago. So it's a good thing to research anyway.
Yeah. Representative Shokia, do you have something?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there a move or a... is there not a desire by the administration to dedicate a gasoline tax?
That's something that has been suggested by Commissioner Turpin and I think does have the support of the administration. Just another indication of having money available for what are considered basic services. The political pressures may require to go elsewhere.
Maybe what if you would just stay there, and maybe I'll take a couple people online here, and that way. Mayor Gilman, are you still online?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Would you have like to make some comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I could identify myself. My name is Don Gilman. I'm mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, Box 144 North Bickley Street, Soldatna, 99669. Mr. Chairman, the borough has taken a position since last year on support for House Bill, House Joint Resolution 38, and also supported the establishment of the debt retirement fund that was passed last session. The reason we do that, Mr. Chairman, is because of the school debt, as Mr. Stastny mentioned in his remarks. There has not been a developed a method in which the school debt can be retired in a certain manner, and those communities that carry a large school debt have supported some type of program such as what you're talking about. Now, we have not taken a position on the percentages of mineral lease rentals or percentages of the other revenues that are called for in here. We think that is a decision that has to be reached by the legislature. So we take no position on that other than to request that there be a section in the Constitution that allows the dedication of those funds. I might add that the school bonding program that was established in about 1971 that was repealed a couple of years ago in what's called House Bill 37 probably is going to be revisited this year because of the demand for school construction that is popping up all over the state. And I think those of you from Anchorage recognize that you have a large bond proposal laying before you and really no mechanism for the state to participate in that bond issue. I would feel that if this particular program were passed, that there could be some way that could be devised to pick up a share of that debt as any other debt might have been issued in this interim period. That ends my remarks. I would be glad to answer any questions.
Mayor, do you recall how many years of the last 5 or 10 or whatever that school construction has been underfunded by the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Stastny is correct that this year, I've been mayor this last time for five, this is my fifth year, this is the first year of that fifth year that it was funded in its entirety. It's ranged anywhere from about 87% to 93% of the entitlement. I believe there was a year about 1982 when the state was pretty flush that there was a 100% entitlement also.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Another question for the record show that we've been doing by Representative Finkelstein. Is there other questions from the committee? Representative Shulkett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your current debt payment is just about $27 million, Don, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you also make a statement as far as the timing, at what point you receive notification of how much your revenues are going to be from the legislature at the last minute.
That isn't as big a problem, Representative Shulkett, as we pretty much have those scheduled payments so that we have them fixed according to what our normal revenue source is, and we don't have a problem with that. What we did have a problem with was 2 years ago when Governor vetoed the bill after our tax bills went out. I mean, there was no way that we could make any adjustment.
As a point of observation, Mr. Chairman, a matter such as this can be handled through a change in the uniform rules. Is that correct? Thank you, Mayor Gilman. I appreciate it.
You mean on the timing for the...
Sure. It could pass out of the legislature at an earlier time.
You know, the problem with that is we don't have to follow our own rules. Representative Larson.
Sure. Back on debt service again. Because I'm going to research this and check it out, but for this past year, Within the reappropriation capital budget bill that we packaged all together, debt service and pupil transportation was vetoed out. In other words, we would have fully funded the prior year if that veto had not taken place.
Representative Brooks.
No, it's my bill. You vetoed it out of it.
Representative Mr. Stassi. Governor's representative. There we go.
I think that was the prior year's veto that was again reading, but I apologize. We stepped up to the plate for our pool debt service last year, but you're right. The attempt to overturn the prior veto through another appropriation last year was vetoed. You're right.
It was the Cooper administration vetoes.
Representative Breckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we speak about school district state bond forgiveness, we had the 80% for years, but I'm not sure, in my recollection as a former school board member here in Anchorage, that it was ever 100% funded. And when we talk 80%, we mean 100% funded. And there were years that, you know, when we talk about close to 100, it was 97%. It wasn't 100%.
And I think what we're referring to is the state paying 100% of their share.
Their share, for instance, was 80%, 100% of aid. But again, when it comes down to the dollar and cents, I'm not sure that you can ever say it was 100% of their portion. It may have been 101 or 98.3%. There's confusion in the language, and I think when we talk about it, we need to be very clear on what we mean.
Mr. Chairman, the tradition, I guess, oftentimes is for the legislature to purposely underfund when you don't know the exact amount required, counting on the supplemental the following year to make up the difference.
Mr. Brighton, also in Soldotna, would you like to comment?
No, I have no comment at this time. I'm interested in this legislation, and I was just here to listen. Was taking place. Thank you.
Yes, sir. In Ketchikan, is Mr. Weinstein there, or is anyone there to comment? I believe he left. Is there anyone else on the teleconference who would like to make a comment on this bill? All right, Mr. Stastny, we've heard this bill. We will take it also with us to Fairbanks to allow the people up there the opportunity to have input into it, and of course we're not moving anything, but trying to get some of this work out of the way so when we get back in Juneau and January, we're able to do so.
Representative, could I make one more comment?
You betcha.
I apologize. You asked me about the dedication of the fuel tax, and that's true. When I guess what I'd like to comment is that this is a different kind of a dedication, and that here we're dedicating the revenues from the sale of an asset. And it's our feeling that when we're selling assets, that money ought to be, at least some of that money ought to be reinvested in more assets rather than selling assets to pay the light bill. And it's our concern that we'll continue paying light bills if we don't put some of the money from the sale of assets away to invest. This debt we have is going to be paid off at our current payment schedule by the end of the century. Also, by the end of the century, as you know, our revenue curve is going to be in a steep decline, absent some more revenues. So the pressure is going to be there for us to pay the light bill. Obviously, we're going to have to pay the light bills. Hopefully, we can learn to turn the switch off every once in a while and be a little more efficient on the light bills we have to pay. But if we take care of our basic needs through purchase of assets and building assets, then we may have to seek other sources of revenues to pay the light bills. But if we take the path of least resistance, which is to not invest the money, we're going to end up with us and our grandchildren having nothing. And one other point that I'd like to make is the fact that in the future, when we have to build assets, obviously, if we have to do that through general obligation bonds, the voters are going to have to vote on whether or not they think we have the resources to pay those bonds. We think a dedicated revenue stream, as this constitutional amendment would create, will give people the security they need to go ahead and step up to the plate and vote for bond issues so that we can take care of some of the things, if that's the way we have to take care of them in the future.
Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stassi, on the governor's transmittal letter, which is in our packets, you may not have a copy.
I do have a copy.
The third paragraph, he speaks of investing the money rather than spending it. What does he mean by that? Certainly, if you invest money, you're spending money. But spending it isn't investing it?
Well, Representative Moyer, I'm an accountant. And if you look at a balance sheet, if you spend money, if you invest money, you move it from one place to another place on the balance sheet, but it's still on the balance sheet. And when you look at your net worth at the end of the year, your net worth hasn't changed or it's gone up. If you spend money to pay the light bill, it goes off of the balance sheet and it goes into the income statement, and if there aren't revenues to offset it on the other side, then your net worth goes down as a result of that expenditure. And that's the difference between investing and spending in my mind. And I haven't looked into the governor's mind, but I expect being a businessman is probably the same.
Other questions from the committee? All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mayor Pavone. The committee will be requested on the chair.
Any comments from the committee? Representative Schoket. I'm not sure what you want me to do. What the hell do I want him to do? I don't know what else to say.
Mr. Chairman?
Have we, go ahead.
The procurement bill was enacted, three, 4 years ago? And at that time, it was the consensus that it wasn't a perfect bill, but it should be looked at in the near future. See where it was and where it was not working. And there are some things in regards to procurement, especially lease of office space and so forth, that does need some investigation. So I think it's a good idea. It's part of the concept of something that should be done. And so I guess if I had any suggestions, it would be to probably contact the administration where they believe it is. not working, and then go from there.
Have you written a letter to them, or have you, you already discussed this with them?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Larson, we've been in contact with both the administration and the private sector. And there's a number of areas. As you stated, one area is leasing. Another area is the, what do they call it, Larry? With the,
do we still have people in line?
Oh, we do?
I'm just going to...
No.
Sole source.
When you contest the bid.
Leaders, I guess we'll leave the committee open.
The, other than, there's a number of areas that we've been working with throughout the last year, that there are some problems on both sides of the fence. And the reason we have not introduced the bill is because the research that needs to be done on this does involve a wide scope of people throughout the state of Alaska that are actively in the private sector dealing with government contracts, or in the public sector dealing with private business. And it's my intentions this interim to bring all that information together. In order to do so, we'd like very much to be able to hold hearings that will allow testimony on the procurement code itself and how we could possibly fix it. Yeah, I think that would, the state's is compatible with Anchorage hearings. We have a bulk of the private sector that works with that. We can go online outside of Anchorage.
Well, why don't you put together some kind of an agenda and something of a letter, something that you're going to send out to these people of what you want to know and stuff, and run it by the committee and see where you're really headed with this and what you want to do. And then get a consensus and do it.
Mr. Chairman, it's not sending out a letter telling people what I want to know. It's gathering information where they perceive the problems are in the procurement code. And my understanding after talking to the speaker was that we had to, you had to give us the authority to do this. I'm asking for the authority to do that.
I guess I'm not sure what you want me to do. You want me to appoint you as a subcommittee, and so that you can call a hearing and have a hearing in this building. Does that satisfy your need?
I would imagine, Mr. Chairman, if that's what you'd like to do.
Well, I don't know. What the hell do you want to do? You're not being real clear to me here. Maybe I'm still thinking of sixth grade level or something here. Sixth grade teacher. Tell me specifically what you want.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to advertise in the public and the private sectors.
Are you asking for money to do so?
Yes.
No, we didn't spend money to do this. You got newspapers. You know, you don't need money. You can do that yourself. I just got a bill for the last one that you had up there in Matsu with the with your river rats. Said to me.
Let it be going as a matter of record that I will be holding hearings on procurement. I had hoped that there would be a formal basis by the State of Affairs Committee so that we could maybe at the start of the session introduce a piece of legislation that is a consensus of how we can cure some of the problems that we're having. I'll do it.
I'm not sure what you really want.
Well, a suggestion, maybe we could add to the upcoming agenda in the November meeting another piece to it.
No, it's got to happen pretty quick. We've let a lot of this slide by.
Addition too, if you
I brought this up because I went to the speaker and said, this is a concern of mine, this is a concern of a lot of ours, that we need to take a look at the procurement code, just like Representative Larson just stated. It wasn't something that was cast in stone. It's something that we've got a lot of areas that we're trying and they're not working very good. And we need to take this and take a look at it. That's what I want to do, to start taking a look at.
I'm just saying, Dave, I don't know why you just can't do that. I mean, call a meeting here, invite whoever you want, invite the, and get find out what the problems are. If there sounds like you're looking for problems instead of knowing what the problems are and trying to solve a problem.
I'm real interested in this too. I worked on the previous procurement bill when I was a staff member, and I'd be interested in helping out. I think it didn't sound like Gene's got any problem with making it a subcommittee activity. We do have money problems with these sort of things, which you can deal with later.
Sure, I'm not worried about the money.
But it sounds like he's happy to have a subcommittee, you know, exist on it. I'll certainly attend any meetings you have because I'm real interested.
Sound like a joint subcommittee.
Well, we'll just form a subcommittee of the whole committee of the House State Affairs, and that's what she'll get to organize to lead us in trying to determine what it is wrong with our procurement code and how we can make it better.
Mr. Chairman, could we perhaps just have an agenda item in our November meeting and perhaps
no problem.
We could have a report on the existing code and then public will know that if there is, you know, if they have comments, it'll be on public record. They could, since that'll be teleconference, they could comment.
We are going to be limited on our time in the November meeting because Finance Committee is going to meet at 1 o'clock, so we've yielded part of our day to them so that we don't overrun. So we're only going to go from 10 to 1. And so we won't have time for, but if Dave, if you guys can have something here, and we'll put it on the agenda, and then you can have a report to us for them. Let the whole committee know.
And that's November 14th? Or
12th. Is that good?
Yeah, I would say by November 12th, then, Larry, we would have a precise identity of some of the areas that are causing concern right now in both fractions.
Put it on the agenda, and if the public wants to do it, we'll all be in session. Has some comments.
So we would have to meet between now and that time to bring that in.
Mr. Chairman, also, since the morning flight to Fairbanks arrives earlier, at 10 a.m.
Larry, hush.
We couldn't start with
hush.
No, well, we also have a, they're going to have a finance meeting earlier, so.
Am I gonna get there at 7 o'clock anyway?
Nobody else is on the
phone.
No, they were in the room. Yes, I don't know how much room you could have.
Where is it?
Are you all right now?
I suppose HB 2300 out of the question, and the committee on that one.
You can. It's your bill, right?
Yeah.
You can get input from all these people and build up your case for that. So you convince this committee.
What's 13?
It's not a fair
job.
Anything else?
Yeah, that was a
story.
The next committee meeting will be
Tuesday, November 12th, 1991. The LIO and Fairbanks, the agenda will be announced prior to that meeting.
That's all people's favorite.